Again, in this passage, we have an event taking place and a conversation, or in this case, a series of conversations about who Jesus is as a result of that. Last time we were considering in chapter 8, where Jesus said, "I am the light of the world," and we looked in more detail at the light of the world. Jesus does actually repeat that again here in verse 5. While I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. But it seems almost secondary to the passage this week. It's not concentrated on so much as to what the light is. But I guess it's the link between him talking about the light of the world following the lights that were in the temple at Tabernacles, and then his light being demonstrated as he opens up the eyes of the blind person. So the person goes from darkness into light. And so we have the theme, light of the world, flowing through the two chapters. And the truth that Jesus is the light of the world is illustrated and confirmed by this healing of the man who is born blind. We ought to note as well in passing that opening the eyes of the blind was a credential of the Messiah. I've listed four verses there in Isaiah the prophet that talk about the fact that one who would come, who would open the eyes of the blind. So it was expected of the Messiah to open the eyes of the blind. Just look at one of those, Isaiah 61 and verse 1. You'll recognise these words, most of you probably as soon as I read them, from Luke's Gospel, but I'm reading them from Isaiah. "The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, and release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn." That's the passage that Jesus read and spoke about in the synagogue when he began his ministry in Galilee. You might say to me, "Well, hang on a minute, didn't you say something about opening the eyes of the blind is part of that role of the Messiah?" But this passage that I've just read out doesn't mention the word blind at all. So what's going on there? Certainly, if you're wondering about Messiah, it doesn't say Messiah either. "The Lord has anointed me." The meaning of anointed, sorry, the meaning of a Messiah is anointed. So that the Messiah is the anointed one. But then if you look down in the end of verse 1, "release from darkness for the prisoners," you'll see there's a footnote. And it says at the bottom, if you can pronounce it, "Septuagint, the blind." So the Old Testament was written in Hebrew, and most of the Hebrew manuscripts say "released from darkness for the prisoners." But the Old Testament was written, translated into Greek, which is the Septuagint. It means there's 70 scholars, apparently, who translated it. They used the word blind when they translated that verse, because that was their understanding of what this was. And you can see releasing from darkness to do with releasing from blindness. So that's why when Jesus then quotes it in Luke, I think it's chapter, I didn't write that in my notes. Yes, here it is in Luke 4, verse 18. "He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed." Because that was their interpretation, their understanding of what the Hebrew meant, that it wasn't just talking about prisoners, but it was talking about blind people as well. And so Jesus claims to be the Messiah as he speaks this passage and says, "I'm fulfilling it in your sight." And then in his ministry, as he opens the eyes of blind people, he continues to demonstrate that he fulfills the role of the Messiah in those ways. Okay, there's a challenge in this passage to think about sickness and perhaps beyond that, suffering in a wider sense. We're introduced to the fact that Jesus saw a man blind from birth. We're not told how he knows he was blind from birth, but apparently that's known, that he's always been blind. And of course, we probably immediately think there's a story coming here about a healing. But that's not the disciples' first reaction to this man who's been born blind. The disciples' first reaction is a theological discussion. Well, here's this chap that's been born blind, so whose fault is that? Did he sin? Did his parents sin? What caused him to be born blind? You might say, well, if he's born blind, how would his own sin have caused him to be born blind? Can he sin before he's born? The Jews did believe that it was possible for unborn children to sin. Jacob may be an example of that. You know, Jacob, when he was born, was grasping on to the heel of his twin brother. He was trying to usurp the role of the elder brother. Maybe that was pre-birth sin, but certainly the Jews did believe it was possible for sin before birth, which is also an interesting sort of sideline, that the humanity of the unborn child, which is a partial argument towards not allowing abortion, because the unborn baby is fully human. But anyway, the disciples just wanted this theological discussion. Who sinned? Parents or the person himself, that he should be born blind? Because they tended to have a strong link between sin and sickness or other misfortunes as well. You know, in the book of Job, where Job has sickness and other misfortunes, his comforters, so to speak, come round him and they say, well, you must have done something wrong for all these terrible things to happen. Because the Jews had that strong link in their minds that bad things only happen when you are bad, when you've done something wrong and God is kind of punishing you. It's also the reason why in some places, in the Psalms, maybe in the Prophets, there's complaints to God. Why are you allowing these bad people to prosper? Because they have this link. You know, bad people shouldn't be prospering. Jesus, however, denies that there is a specific sin that's the problem here. No, it wasn't the parents. It wasn't the person that sinned and caused this blindness. If we think in a general sense of what the Bible says about sickness and any kind of misfortune, I guess, then sin is the cause. We go back to Genesis, creation was created good. But in Genesis chapter 3, the first man and the first woman turned away from God. And we hear about how things went downhill from there. Problems, disorder entered into creation. Sickness and strife came in. So in a sense, all sickness is a result of sin, in a general sense. But when it comes to specific sicknesses or specific sins causing specific sicknesses, you cannot be so certain. There is a case for saying that sometimes a specific sin causes an illness. We're going to take communion later on, and 1 Corinthians chapter 11 is a passage where Paul teaches about communion. And he says in verse 30, well, maybe word of introduction first, he talks about those who are abusing communion. They weren't waiting for people, servants who were Christians might be late to the communion service because they had to serve in the household first. But the rich Christians didn't always wait in Corinth. They just got on with it, and they had their they used to have a meal together as well and share communion. But they just got on with it, and the poor, the servants came late, and they were abused in that way. And Paul says, if you're not really treating communion properly, then there's a problem. And he goes on in verse 30 and says, that is why many among you are weak and sick, and a number of you have fallen asleep. So it certainly seems from that passage that sometimes specific sins and ignoring God, not following God properly, while claiming to follow God properly, specific sins can cause sickness, or maybe not cause, maybe that's too strong a word. God may allow you to have sickness and suffering because of some specific sin. And he even goes there to say fallen asleep. And that's not just because the preacher went on too long in the communion service. That's a euphemism for dying because of their sickness. There can be a link between sickness and specific sins, but it's not always the case. Paul speaks in his second letter to the Corinthians about a problem that he had, the thorn in the flesh, 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Just look at verses 7 to 10. Paul's just spoken about the fact that he had a very striking vision of God, not a common kind of thing, but very in-depth vision. And then he goes on to say, to keep me from becoming conceited, because of these surpassing great revelations, there was given me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. 3 times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. There's a lot of discussion about what exactly Paul's thorn in the flesh was, but many commentators think it was some kind of sickness. But God did not heal it. He didn't take it away. It wasn't because of a sin of Paul's. But it seems as if God is allowing it to benefit Paul, to keep him humble, to keep him reliant upon God, reliant on God's strength rather than his own strength for his ministry. So God can use sicknesses, and he may allow a sickness or a difficulty to remain with us for his purposes. And indeed, if we turn back to John chapter 9, Jesus says, in this case, this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. In this case, it's going to lead to a healing, but the work of God is not always a healing. The work of God may be that strength given in sickness. But for the blind man in John chapter 9, the purpose is for this revelation of Jesus' healing power. Jesus didn't heal everyone, though. You know, we had the story a few weeks back of the pool that was stirred, and whoever was first in the pool was healed. And it talked about a crowd there. And Jesus healed one person. And why didn't he heal them all? Here we have the healing of this man who's begging by the temple. In Acts chapter 3, sometime later, after Jesus' ministry, and Jesus has been to the temple many times, Peter and John meet someone that's begging by the temple. He's lame, and they heal him. Well, didn't Jesus pass him? It says he was there a long time, many years. Why didn't Jesus heal him during his ministry on earth? Jesus doesn't heal everyone. Why does he heal some but not others? Unfortunately, we don't have a straight down the line answer on that, but I can give you. It's a call for us to trust in the Lord. Sometimes he heals and reveals his glory through healing. Sometimes he doesn't heal. He's willing, if that person seeks him, to give strength in that situation. But he doesn't always heal. He doesn't always heal. And that's a matter of trust. The Bible doesn't shy away from discussing these things. We need to trust the Lord. Another example, perhaps a more extreme example, in Acts, the Apostle James, brother of John, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, James is put to the sword quite early in the book of Acts. He's, you know, captured, put to the sword. But just a short while later in Acts, we read that Peter's put in prison, and in the night, an angel comes and releases him from prison, and he's saved. Why did God allow James to die? You might say the same about Stephen, who was stoned. Why did he allow them to die, but he miraculously releases Peter? We don't know. It's in God's purposes. And we need to trust that God knows what he's doing, because he can see all things in all time. Trust in him. So I'm not sure whether that challenge of sickness, that discussion there, comes straight out of John chapter 9, but hopefully that's a few thoughts about that and something we can trust the Lord concerning. Let's look a little bit at the compassion of Jesus. First of all, the healing itself is an expression of Jesus' compassion as he meets a physical need of the man who is blind. He heals his sight. I've already mentioned that there's more than one story in the Gospels of people healing people who are blind. He uses a different method each time, which is interesting. Jesus isn't tied to one particular method, and as we pray for people or minister to people, we should remember that. We haven't got to use one specific formula for prayer, but different things can be used in different times, different situations. But the healing, of course, is not the end. It's quite early on in the chapter. And we lead into this discussion, first the blind man and his neighbours. Are you really our neighbour? How is it that you can see now? Perhaps you're someone else. And then the neighbours, very kind of them, take him up in front of the Pharisees. And the Pharisees, of course, are not very receptive to the idea that Jesus should heal, especially because he did it on the Sabbath, and we've discussed that before. Jesus seems to, whether it's just because they're more remarkable because of the discussion afterwards, he seems to heal on the Sabbath quite a lot. He's making a point that it's actually a good thing. Good things can take place on the Sabbath. Don't restrict good things on the Sabbath. But the man, through this process of his physical healing and his being brought before the Pharisees, he's dis-synagogued. He's thrown out of the synagogue as part of this, but he's still making a spiritual journey. Jesus goes and finds him. And that's part of what I was trying to get over in the children's talk, that actually God looks for us as well as us looking for God. Jesus finds him and leads him further in his understanding. So first, in verse 11, the man says about Jesus, it's just the man they call Jesus. And although we think of Jesus as a special name, it was a common name in those days, Yeshua. Same as Joshua, that we would write it in the Old Testament. In verse 17, he seems to go a bit further, and he says he's a prophet. He's a prophet. In the Old Testament, you can read about the prophets, and some of them particularly had healing ministries. Elijah and Elisha. You can read about many healings that they did, and that may be the sense in which here he's thinking of him as a prophet, a man sent from God and able to do healings. And he goes on in verse 33, if this man were not from God, he could do nothing. God must be with him because he's able to open the eyes of a man born blind. So he's learning more about Jesus as he thinks and reflects, and he answers the Pharisees' questions. But then Jesus comes to find him and takes him a step further. In verse 35, do you believe in the Son of Man? Who is he, sir? The man asked. Tell me so that I may believe in him. Jesus said, you've now seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking with you. Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. The Son of Man sounds like a very human title, doesn't it? Son of Man. But actually, it has a divine implication, a divine connotation. We could turn to Daniel chapter 7. We won't do just now. But Daniel 7 introduces the Son of Man. And he's coming on the clouds. And who rides on the clouds of glory except God himself? It's the picture from the wandering in the desert of the cloud of glory that accompanied the people of Israel in their wanderings through the desert. And the Son of Man rides on that cloud of glory because he is the divine Son of Man. He is God. And that's what Jesus is talking about there. First of all, the man is very respectful. Who is he, sir? And then he's very worshipful. Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. The word sir and the word Lord are the same word in Greek. It has a smaller vocabulary. So when it's translated into English, that's why you can sometimes get different words used from the same Greek word. The context reveals that in the second case it's Lord because he worships him. So it's appropriate to have that stronger meaning of the word rather than just sir again. But there's the conclusion that he doesn't just know who Jesus is, but he worships him. He worships him. The Greek word means to draw near to kiss. There's an intimacy in that. It wasn't considered literal, but that was the background of the word. It's an intimate word to worship. Jesus, of course, accepts that worship, which again is evidence that Jesus is claiming to be God, because he receives worship that should only be given to God. In the book of Acts, you can see the apostles tell people not to worship them when they do miracles because they're not claiming to be God. But Jesus accepts worship because he is God. And so the man has taken a journey and he's met not just with a healer, not just with a prophet, he's met with the Son of Man. He's met with the Lord. Just to close off, Jesus mentions spiritual blindness and sight. The physical eyes and the spiritual eyes of the man born blind have been opened. He knows who Jesus is. But the Pharisees refuse to believe. They have the evidence in front of them, but they just cannot accept it, and so they remain in their blindness. Jesus makes a point that disbelief through ignorance is different to disbelief through stubbornness. The Pharisees claim to have sight. They've seen the evidence. And they still claim that there's a different way. And so Jesus' words for them are particularly harsh. Their eyes, their spiritual eyes, are still firmly closed. So our great God, God in the flesh, Jesus Christ, has opened the eyes of the blind, the physical eyes and the spiritual eyes. Has he opened our eyes? Do we see him clearly as the Lord? And do we fall in worship before him? Amen.